Good morning, everyone. I'm going to open up the Senate Judiciary Committee for this Monday morning. First, I want to apologize to committee and to staff. I'm running a little bit late because I had to be down in rules this morning to testify on a bill, and they got me in as quick as they could, and so we're running about 5 minutes later than we had anticipated, but hope everyone had a good weekend. And with that, we're going to have a presentation today from the Pew Charitable Trust. And Council, did you want to give us an overview?
Sure, members of the committee, we have Jake Horowitz here from the Public Safety Performance Project. You have written material. He has more in-depth written material, but it's probably caught in a snowdrift in Washington, D.C. He's here to talk about less crime at lower cost. We will be applying for CLE credit for the lawyer legislators and the other lawyers in the audience who would like to use the sign-up sheet. Mr. Horowitz came, as I said, from Washington, D.C., as you mentioned, the Pew Charitable Trust.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Horowitz, thank you for being here. Just to let you know, we have joining us Senator Shields, who has had a keen interest in public safety and the cost of it. And then I was going to have Senator Dingfelder introduce her guest, but we'll do that later. With that, if you'd like to get started, if you'll give us your name, and we're all ears.
Okay. Great. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a lot more fun being out here with 55-degree weather than shoveling, which is what I was doing for the past week in D.C. I also thank you for sharing your time, particularly during a short legislative session when you'll be forced to face a lot of tough policy choices forced by the budget. It's both more valuable and it's also but it's also really good time to talk about these issues. Sentencing corrections is what I'll be discussing this morning. And one of the big takeaway points I want to lay out is that this is not a zero-sum game where if you spend less, you're going to have more crime. There are states pushing ahead with innovative solutions across the country, led by both Republicans and Democrats, and members from across the three branches of government that are finding ways to achieve more public safety at lower cost. So I represent the Public Safety Performance Project, which is an operating project that the Pew Charitable Trust established. The project was established back in 2006. Our goals are to help states advance fiscally sound, data-driven policies and practices and sentencing and corrections that improve public safety, hold offenders accountable, and contain corrections spending. Brief overview of how we go about doing this is primarily through intensive state technical assistance. So we partner up with working groups of bipartisan interbranch members representing various stakeholder groups. We analyze the drivers of correctional populations and costs. We audit policies. We help these working groups identify options they would like to explore, and then we simulate the impacts of those options on public safety and spending. And then we assist in the implementation and passage of these policies and practices and track their implementation rigorously. Nationally, we engage with various stakeholder groups. Our two main technical assistance providers are the Council of State Governments Justice Center and the Vera Institute of Justice, but we also work with the National Conference of State Legislatures, the National Governors Association, the National Center on State Courts, and various other technical assistance and interest groups, such as the Crime and Justice Institute, Prison Fellowship, the Texas Public Policy Foundation, et cetera. So real quickly, the overview of what we'll be discussing this morning first is a picture of sentencing and corrections trends, both nationally and how Oregon fits into that picture. Then I want to jump into why the conversation is changing and how it's changing. And finally, illustrate some options that states are now choosing and how they've played out over the last several years. So let's jump into it. Some of these figures will be, you'll have seen these before, but just want to make sure that we're starting from the same basic picture here. The prison population has tripled over the past two decades. The nation now has 1.6 million prisoners. This follows a period of remarkable stability pre-1970. Right? The incarceration rate of the United States held virtually stable at slightly over 100 per 100,000 for the first 70 years of this of the last century, and then began this remarkable climb. If you add in jail inmates to this prison count, you achieve a total of about 2.3 million, which is one of every 100 adults in the country. And the last point to make here is that this population growth is largely driven by policies. This is not the inevitable result of changes in demographics or the economy or changes in crime rates. These populations are driven by policy decisions about who goes to prison and how long they stay. along with this growth in population is a growth in cost. Incarceration is intensely labor and capital intensive. It's largely about bricks and mortars and staffing. So as the population increases, so do the costs. States now spend one in every 15 general fund dollars on corrections across the country. It's the second fastest expanding major segment of state spending behind Medicaid. And while correction spending includes more than just prisons, prisons dominate this category of state spending. We'll get into some of the details in a minute. Looking beyond prison and jail inmates, we have to look at the entire correctional population. Most supervised offenders in this country are not behind bars. About two out of every three are actually supervised in the community under probation, parole, and community corrections programs. You total them all up, we're talking about 7.3 million individuals. And this growth in the correctional population is led by probation, which has tripled in the past 25 years. Adding it all up, one in every 31 adults in the country is now under correctional control. And this ratio of community corrections, including probation and parole, to prison and jail inmates has held virtually constant over this period of growth. So back in 1970, about two out of every three supervised individuals is in the community. Today, about two out of every three. It's just that both populations have massively expanded, keeping that ratio constant. Jumping into the costs that go along with these populations.
Money is not where the people are.
Corrections is entirely or largely dominated by prison spending. These are figures from a study we released last year. The pie chart shows that across 34 states that responded to our request for data, 9 in every 10 correctional dollars went to prisons. Right? So only 1 in 10 went to probation and parole. And then we looked at the bar chart here shows that across 8 states that were able to report data from fiscal year 83 to fiscal year, 2008, 88% of the additional correction spending went into prisons. So as the budgets for corrections expanded, it was largely driven by prison growth. Very small part of that change was driven by probation and parole growth. Lastly, on this point, I also want to thank Oregon, because Oregon is actually one of the states representing both of these charts. And if it were not for states like Oregon that participate in our surveys and provide data and track this stuff, we wouldn't have national figures to present you today. So thank you for that. Now I want to turn from national statistics to Oregon statistics. These are the Oregon correctional populations over the past 25 years. Overall, smaller rates of correctional control in Oregon, but the trend, that is the growth in these areas, largely mirrors national trends. Oregon correctional costs, again, less money than a lot of states spend overall because it's a smaller state, doesn't compare on the scale of states like California and Texas and Florida, but the same trends persist. Growth across correctional spending categories, but largely that growth is concentrated in prison spending as opposed to probation and parole. And then as with other states, the growth both in the populations and the spending is driven by policies, not by crime rates, not by demographic shifts, not by the economy. This is a quote I took from, which it doesn't appear here in the bottom. It's supposed to credit the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, a prison population forecast they released in 2009. And that second sentence pretty much sums it up, that sentence lengths as opposed to crime rates are the most significant driver of the inmate population. So these are not state spending categories beyond the control of state policymakers. They're very much in your hands. And finally, this is another chart pilfered from the CJC website, showing that essentially this is your prison population from 95 to 06, and that blue band across the bottom is what the prison population would look like were it not for additional policy changes. And then on top of that are layered the prison population impacts of Measure 11 and other enhancement bills and ballot measures over the years that essentially increase the projection for prison populations. So let's dive into crime rates quickly because I think there's a lot of good news here for Oregon. These are your property and violent crime rates over the past 20 years. It's good news, right? Both rates are declining quickly and at lows for the past two or three decades. we then compare Oregon to some other states with violent crime rates, again, quite a good picture. The average citizen on the street is safer in Oregon than other states. This is good news for the state. But note that violent crime declined everywhere. Right? This is a national decline. It was not limited to Oregon. States that took different policies largely experienced large declines in violent crime. And finally, turning to property crime, the news overall is good. Crime rates have decreased. But here, Oregon is both above the national average and above states like California and some of your other neighbors. You're doing quite well on violent crime compared to other states, not doing quite as well on property crime compared to other states, but still a large improvement over a 20-year period. So to sort of sum up this first part about where we are with national trends and state trends, a lot of good things going on in Oregon. Large decreases in crime and a comparatively low violent crime rate, legislative endorsement of evidence-based practices, a mandate for administrative sanctioning and community supervision, including probation and parole, or post-release supervision, as it's called in the state. Solid data and research upon which to ground debates on these policies. And overall, a modest incarceration rate, which means that incarceration is the most expensive of all correctional options. All the things being equal, the more you can contain that population, the cost, better favors you're doing for your taxpayers. And this is nationally viewed as Oregon's made a good use of probation and parole, and has largely prioritized its prison space for violent offenders as opposed to lower level drug and property offenders. So there's some good news here. And an additional point here is that last year Pew released a policy framework for community corrections. It's sort of our recommendations for how states can best advance their community corrections programs and policies. And two of Oregon's policies, the evidence-based practices and the administrative sanctions, were featured in our report. So, Oregon was modeled, our policy framework was in part modeled on Oregon policies. But there are still challenges remaining for the state. The prison population is projected to increase about 18% to 16,500 by 2020. And correctional cost growth continues amidst a period of constrained budgets that you're all too aware of. So corrections is now consuming about 1 in every 9 state general fund dollars in the state, debt service exceeding $100 million per biennium, and the DOC, when it comes down to sort of your average taxpayer, is consuming more than $700 per household per biennium. I don't want to go point by point through this slide, but the landscape is shifting. The fourth bullet down there cites the fiscal crisis, and that's about where I would put it as far as why the landscape is changing. States have been tackling sentencing corrections policies in a new way for several years, and this well predates the current fiscal crisis. That said, it is adding additional pressure. The other point I just want to point to here is the third about managing for results. You've probably heard the story of Bill Bratton, former police chief of New York City, then Los Angeles, who said many years ago in a move that really changed policing in this country that the police are going to be held responsible for crime in New York City. That's our responsibility. That's the metric that we're in charge of. This was a new thing for policing to say at that point. And sentencing corrections is moving in that direction. We can't overstate it. We're not there yet. But in more and more cases across the country, corrections, community corrections, judges are saying crime is our responsibility, and that's the metric we should be held accountable for. And this is putting additional pressure to really put in place practices and policies that contain contain crime in the most cost-effective way. But we're trailing behind policing and some other fields that have been doing this for years. So, what it comes down to, across all these things, the fiscal pressure, the growing populations, the shifting landscape, is that the question policymakers are asking, and this is not really my opinion, this is sort of what we see in states across the country, is that the old question was, how do I do the best job of sort of showing I'm tough on crime? What kind of enhancements can I look for? Different policies that sort of, evidence that I'm pounding the fist. The other, the shift is now to a different question, which is how do we get the best public safety return on our investment for taxpayers? And it's a very different question, and it's leading states in different policy directions. So I want to show a couple examples of how states are tackling this. The two states feature are both states where our project, through its partner, the Council of State Governments Justice Center, provided intensive technical assistance in the 2007 legislative session. The first is Kansas. So walking into their 2007 legislative session, Kansas projected a 22% prison population increase by 2016, which was going to cost the state $500 million in additional spending. Next, they put together this bipartisan interbranch working group to say, okay, what's driving this population? What they discovered in fiscal year 06 was that 65% of their admissions were probation and parole violators. So folks who were not showing up in the DOC because they'd committed a new crime, necessarily, and they certainly hadn't been convicted of it, but they had violated some condition of their community supervision. It was costing taxpayers over $50 million per year to incarcerate these individuals. So the solutions they came up with, the first was a grant program from the state to local counties who created plans to reduce revocations by 20%. So it was aligning the fiscal incentive of the state with the performance incentive that folks wanted, right? If you can reduce the rate at which folks commit new crimes, violate the conditions of supervision, and return to the state where we spend $30,000 a year, let's say, on their incarceration, that's a win-win for both the county and the state, and there should be some profit sharing in that relationship. The second was the introduction of a 60-day credit for risk reduction programs. So if you are diagnosed with a substance abuse disorder and you participate and complete a program aimed at that criminogenic need, that thing that, that drives you in part to the crimes you commit, then you should be rewarded for that and be really receive a 60-day credit against your sentence. And finally, they restored earned time for nonviolent inmates. The outcomes of this were across the board positive. Parole revocations decreased 46%. Parole reconvictions were down 26%. So this is not an issue of parole officers simply turning a blind eye to criminal behavior. The reconvictions, something that parole officers have no control over, that is produced through arrests and new pleas and trials, decreased across this population at the same time that the population was increasing. Probation revocations dropped 28%, and the state overall averted $80 million in spending over a five-year period. The next example, so moving from Kansas, which has a prison population about two-thirds the size of Oregon's, to Texas, which has a prison population 10 times the size of your state's. So we got states at other end of the spectrum moving down a similar path as far as the process they took to this, right? So put together this bipartisan interbranch working group to analyze the drivers. Again, this is a state which, walking into its 07 session, had built 100,000 prison beds over two decades. Despite this prison construction, they forecasted the need for 14 to 17,000 more prison beds by 2012. So the building hadn't alleviated the problem, as it were, in Texas. They were projecting $500 million in additional costs for fiscal year 09 alone, all right, to put sort of budgets in perspective here. But then they turned to the analysis. They found high recidivism rates, low parole grant rates, and technical violators as a primary driver of their prison population. Again, it's not about the specifics of what they found. It's about the process they went about to find these solutions. And the solutions included an expanded network of residential and community diversion and treatment facilities into which they invested $240 million. And they requested essentially that the parole board comply with the statutorily mandated grant rate, which had been well below for a couple years. The outcomes, probation revocations down 26%, parole revocations down 4%, actual savings of over $500 million in the fiscal biennium 08-09, and estimated savings much larger in downstream savings, because this prison population, which had been projected to achieve very substantial increases, was flatlined and in fact has started decreasing over the past several years. Just as a side note to this, one of the leaders of this legislative, this is a bipartisan team, Senator John Whitmire, Democrat of Houston, Jerry Madden, a Republican of Plano, worked together, right? So joint House-Senate meetings, R's and D's together. Jerry Madden, as part of this whole process, actually took some of the savings achieved through averted prison growth and channeled several million dollars into nurse-family partnerships, right? And he said, the reason I'm doing this is because these programs, nurse-family partnerships, achieve a better public safety return on investment. If I move dollars from low return on investment programs to high return on investment, people will be safer and will save money. So to sort of distill out these two examples of Kansas and Texas to the common denominators, there's a lot on this slide, and I want to just sort of pause on this slide for a few minutes because there's some really interesting things here. The first is that one common denominator to these states and other states we've worked in, well over half a dozen in the past couple years, is that they screen and sort offenders by risk to public safety, right? So As an example, in Virginia, they have a guideline system in some ways similar to yours, but on top of that guideline system, they've layered on a risk assessment tool that says, if you score in the bottom quartile, 25% on risk, and you're in the guideline system as headed towards prison, you'll in fact be diverted. Right? So they identified a level of risk they were comfortable with as a state. And they said, above that, you are, you know, you're deserving of a prison cell, and the taxpayer should be willing to pay for that cell. Below it, you know, we can tolerate that risk, and we're going to instead channel the money we save by not sending you to prison and put it into probation and parole and supervise you properly in the community. And risk by offender varies dramatically. I think in our report from last year, 1 in 31, we highlighted what we call the myth of the average prisoner. And the reason it's a myth is that there's a massive variation amongst folks who head to prison in the harms they cause to society and in the problems they face. So one example of that is essentially first-timers. If you take almost any state system and look at recidivism rates and look at the folks who, the recidivism rates of folks who went to prison for the first time versus the recidivism rate of the folks who have been to prison before, you see massive differences. Very substantial. This is very predictable across states. And so you need to take a look at not just priors and the current offensive conviction, but a bunch of other variables that are very predictive of the risk of reoffense as well as the stakes of those reoffense, so how harmful the recidivism will be. And again, the third point here is on, I just took a look at some statistics on the Oregon websites indicating that of folks in your prison system, about 15% are diagnosed as having severe mental health problems, about 60% having severe substance abuse problems. So it's important to look not just at the risks these folks pose to society, but the needs that we need to attend to while they're behind bars or while they're under community supervision so they're reduced risk of reoffense to the community. The second, moving from screening and sorting by risk, is to move to creating incentives for performance. So this exists both at the state level and at the individual level. At the state level, what we're seeing a lot of states take up is this is the example from Kansas, where there's a state link to the localities through money, right? They say, if you reduce revocations, if you reduce new crimes, and the demand that counties and localities place on the state for incarceration services, we will give you some money so that you can support your services, your supervision, the sanctions you use, because you're saving us money and you're saving citizens from future victimization. So we're willing to support that. This happened not just in Kansas. California passed a law this past year. Illinois passed a law instituting these kinds of state-local fiscal incentive programs. Arizona's is perhaps the most aggressive and innovative. And what they've done there is said, it's not just that we're going to give you a grant and you need to now institute a plan to reduce revocations and new crimes. It actually pays on a per offender basis. So what it says is to every county in Arizona, if you can reduce revocations and new crime commitments from your county, we will channel 40% of the savings per offender back into your county. So if it cost us X thousand dollars to incarcerate them in the past, we'll now pay you 0.4X in return for keeping them in the community, towing the line, abiding by their conditions of supervision, paying victim restitution, child support, taxes, etc. And they view that as a win-win. But it's not just a state-local issue. You also need to provide incentives for individual offenders. And this brings us into the area, the most obvious example is earn time. So, and I understand this is a current issue under debate in Oregon, and if we want to later, we'd be glad to dive into some of the specifics on earn time and what the research indicates around it. But what we're seeing a lot of states do is find ways to both incentivize good behavior behind bars, right? So a lot of correctional administrators appreciate earn time because it gives them more control over their institutions. It's one of the very few carrots they have to keep folks in line behind bars. But it's not just used behind bars. States like Nevada and others have, and I believe Oregon under 3508, provides earn time off probation and parole as well. And there's two good benefits of that. The first is you incentivize good behavior, which is what you want. The second is if you can move certain offenders, the lower risk, the ones who prove that they can abide by the rules, if you move them off your rolls, you can then concentrate your existing resources on the problem offenders who are failing to abide by those rules. And finally, the third bullet here, and the third movement we're seeing states do, heading is finding ways to construct reliable deterrence. The high property crime rate in Oregon indicates that just sort of demands a focus on the 30,000-plus probation and post-release supervised offenders. Because these are probably folks who are at an increased likelihood of committing these crimes, probably commit a disproportionate share of them. So you can do this both through administrative sanctioning, right? So the swift and certain sanctions that have been proven to be the most effective deterrents. So, you know, years of criminological research. And now back up the point that if you look at what is, you know, the largest determinant of deterrence, the ability to dissuade people in advance of committing the crime, it is not severity. Severity has very little impact on the deterrent power of a message. The most important parts of the message are the certainty with which it'll be delivered and the swiftness. So we recognize this in how we sort of raise children and train a puppy. Right? When the puppy does something bad, you don't wait a few weeks and then slap it on the nose and throw it out the door pretty violently. Right? That'll have no effect on its behavior. What you do is something swift and certain, but relatively mild. Right? So this is essentially the same thing goes for changing human behavior. And I know HOPE has received some discussion here in Oregon, but this is probably the best current example we have, and certainly the example with the best research we have currently. So the HOPE model is a different way of doing probation. What happens in it is a judge working with probation, law enforcement, treatment providers, as well as the Department of Corrections, will say to probationers, look, we have a deal. And the deal is that you're under community supervision, but you're agreeing to abide by all the rules we place on you. And if you don't abide by those rules, in particular, if you continue to use drugs, which we know is driving a lot of crime, you will receive swift and certain sanctions every time, guaranteed. And so these individuals, probationers on HOPE, call a 1-800 hotline every morning. And the hotline randomly requests them to come in and provide a urine sample. And if they test dirty, they are arrested on the spot. They have a hearing scheduled 2 days later. And the judge at these hearings generally imposes a sentence of 3 to 7 days of jail. A very mild sanction, right? This is not revoking a person for the remainder of their sentence and sending them back to the state where they'll rack up bills, which in Hawaii are $50,000 per year for incarceration. And so you think, how is a day in jail going to change, or 3 days in jail going to change the behavior of a hardcore drug user? And we can get back to how that works, but the results prove it does work. A randomized controlled trial funded by National Institute of Justice just came out showing that under the HOPE program, folks put in the program were arrested for a new crime 55% less often, tested dirty for drugs 72% less often, skipped meetings with their probation officer 61% less often, were revoked 53% less often, and were sentenced to or served 48% fewer days behind bars. So this is right the example that we go back to. Is it possible to have more public safety, more offender accountability at lower cost? And HOPE and some other programs are showing that indeed it's possible. Finally, and this is the last of the policy slides, and then I'd be glad to sort of engage in more of a discussion, questions and answers. We're seeing a bunch of other options that don't fit neatly into any bag, but I didn't want to leave here without mentioning them. And these are just, I put one state example up here for each of these options, but this actually comes from a larger presentation that has entire slides for each of these. So a lot of states are doing these. The first is redefining criminal offenses. So the example here is that Alabama raised Class C felony thresholds from $250 to $500 and Class Bs to $2,500. And they projected a 3,000 prison bed savings over 5 years based on that change. And what this gets to is that a lot of states put in place felony thresholds for theft, let's say, and they've never indexed them for inflation. So while back in the day, stealing a TV, you know, the TV might have been worth a couple hundred bucks. Now the TV is worth a lot more than that. But the threshold hasn't changed. And so folks, essentially, you know, we index other prices. We don't largely index theft thresholds or other thresholds. The second is reclassifying existing criminal offenses. So the case here is that Iowa downgraded burglary offenses involving cars and boats as opposed to residences and businesses by creating new Class D felony and aggravated misdemeanor categories. Another example is simply changing sentencing options for judges. In Pennsylvania, they now grant the judges the option to sentence offenders to an early risk reduction release date conditioned on successful program completion. And the last example here is states simply building up real robust analysis and research capacities. North Carolina led the charge in this several years ago, developing a very strong sentencing commission, prison population projection capacity, offender information systems, and the state, as well as other states like Pennsylvania, has got another very strong system. The state, the legislators, the executive branch, and the judiciary largely rely on these institutions to provide them unbiased evidence, research, and provide options that they can consider for ways to really improve public safety, really get to sort of beef up their offender accountability, which has been a phrase that gets tossed around a lot, but it largely is, you know, it's unclear in some cases how seriously it's taken, while preserving state taxpayer dollars. So that is the end of what I prepared and really wanted to deliver here, but I'd be glad to discuss some more and see where the gathered folks want to go.
All right, so we're going to open up the dais for questions or comments. Anyone want to start? Senator Boquist.
I've got about six.
Go right ahead. That's
what we're here. I'm trying to refer to the slides so I can write the notes down. Third or fourth slide in, you had $7 million in counting, about two-thirds of...
Why don't you identify the slide?
Wish I could, but it...
Well, you can say on the top what it is.
Yeah, it says $7 million in counting right there.
Okay.
I looked for page numbers to write it down.
I apologize.
You didn't do page numbers.
Well, the reason I want to... Members, if you're going to go to the slides, say what it is so we can have some reference on the record. So if someone's looking at the...
Can you expand a little bit on this slide here? I mean, we talk about 7 million, about two-thirds are probation, and one-third is basically, I guess it looks like, jail and prison and parole. Is that a nationwide average? How does Oregon compare to that? What do other states look like in terms of that?
Sure. So what this, you know, the bar on the far right is the current correctional population in the United States in absolute numbers. So it indicates there's 7.3 million Americans currently under, who are either under probation or parole supervision or in jail or prison. The two-thirds, one-third is simply a ratio. Two-thirds of those 7.3 million are in the community under probation and parole supervision. One-third are behind bars in jail or prison. Oregon overall, as it compares, let's talk first absolute rates. So 1 in 100 American adults or adults in America are behind bars. 1 in 45 are under probation and parole supervision. In Oregon, you have a lower incarceration rate, but a slightly higher community correction supervision rate.
Follow up. If you flip to the next page, you have 23 states. And you talk about growth here, and then the pie charts on the left, that amount of dollars for about 12% of spent on parole and probation and 88% is spent on prisons. In the Oregon model, on the Oregon side, roughly what are we, do you know?
I'm not sure on Oregon's numbers. Let me see if we have a ratio here.
Are we about the same 12% of the dollars spent on?
So this would be the chart to turn to. I haven't constructed the ratio here. What this indicates is that as of fiscal year 08, Oregon spent $454 million on prison, 89 on probation, and 31 on parole or post-release supervision. So we just have to add those up and divide. We could figure it out.
Run those, because we're not colored, so
I apologize for that. The top line is prison, so $454 million
on prison. Right, 3743, is that prison or? The lower left corner number, so I can, you have prison, probation, and parole.
Oh yeah, so what you want to look at is the 2008 figures on the left-hand part, so total spending per year. The top figures, $454 million on prison, $89 million on probation, and $31 million on parole. So that looks like about...
So prison was 37, right?
Looks like... it was 37 back in 1983.
Okay.
37.
Parole.
No, that's got to be a typo on the 37, but the 08 numbers are correct in there. I'll have to go look at what...
On the right side?
What's going on there with the prison figure.
Yeah. Maybe we could convince him to email us his PowerPoints, Mr.
Absolutely.
Chair. We can see the colors later. We can figure out what the numbers say.
Mr. Chairman, well, of the committee, there's a whole bunch of stuff in the mail probably stuck in the snowdrift in D.C. So.
All right. My clarification, when you look at these charts, it appears the way it's set up is that the numbers that correlate to the identification, so on the top one, It says prisons, and you can see the first one that's listed is prisons, the next is probation, and the following, the last one is parole.
That's correct.
So you read from the top to bottom.
But that is slightly changed on the per offender per day, but that's correct for the total spending.
So if I read that chart correctly, it looks like we're spending more on parole and probation than we are in the other categories.
Pardon?
If you look at the cost of offenders per day.
Yep.
The very top, I guess the blue top is the line going up the right-hand side. That's $84.43 per day is prison.
That's correct.
And then probation is $12.
That's correct.
Got it.
Actually, it's parole, it's $12 there, and probation is $7.89.
Great, thanks.
So you spend roughly seven times as much on on prison as you do on community supervision per day.
Thank you. Follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If you flip to the Pew chart that has measure 11 in it, and that's got a little white gap, I think that's it right there, the colors right there. Base percentage of felons, that area that's down below that's kind of level, and you made reference earlier that, you know, that's pretty common in all of the states across here, that whole blue block that's down there, that baseline block. Give a rough idea from a national level versus a state level of how many of those are property crimes, how many of those are violent felons, what's the breakout of the baseline?
Sure.
It's
tough to say baseline. Most states, you know, won't break out projections in this way, but let's just talk about prison populations from state to state. Across the country, state prison populations generally have about 50% of the offenders behind bars are there for person or violent offenses. About 25% are on property. About 20% are on drugs. And the remainder, other offenses, other kind of statutory violations. In Oregon, and this is numbers I pulled from Oregon state websites, so take that with that caveat. The indication I have is about 70% are in on violent or person offenses, about 15% on property, and about 10% on drugs. So you guys have a larger share of your prison population are behind bars on violent, and a lower share are there on property and drug.
Thank you. If you flip to the next slide, these are the Oregon crime rates, and down on the right side, you got property crime versus violent crime. And I represent five rural counties, and I guess you could say they're poor, but this property versus violent reporting and how the statistics come out is very interesting to me, and that's because most of the counties I have established a threshold, some of them as high as $5,000 on a property crime before they can afford to actually prosecute the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And so the property crimes almost falls off the spectrum of the charge. So when you talk about crime rates here, are these crime rates that are reported, or are these crime rates that are prosecuted?
No.
Because later on, there's some analysis of how you can save money, and if you take it from my five counties' perspective, we're on the other side of the bell curve. We've already saved that money because we're not prosecuting these people because we can't afford to.
So just speaking about this slide here, and the one thing I want to point out is that I multiplied the violent crime rate by 10 to put it on the same scale. So keep, you know, don't think that there are 5,000 violent crime rates per 100,000 people in Oregon. That's not the case. These
are reported crimes. These are FBI UCR statistics as reported by the state to the feds.
That's all this is. This is not an actual victimization survey. This is just what's reported.
I think I only have two more questions. If you flip along to as the landscape shifts right there, looking through at some of these issues that are through here, and we talk about, you know, behavior and trends and trying to save money, so on and so forth like that. Has there been a study done of, you know, because crime rates are dropping,
mm-hmm.
and we've obviously saved money from prosecution and from prison, and then is there a corresponding savings for every level of percentage we go down in the crime rate that we save money in the private sector too?
Particularly damages. In the private sector?
Yeah. Damages. I mean,
I'm not aware. There's probably some research out there. I'm not aware of that as far as, you know, costing out savings from reduced crime. There's probably some. I mean, I've seen some large figures. The problem is that the putting dollar figures on crime is a tough assignment. You know, on the one hand, there are savings that are accrued by the state through, like you say, reduced law enforcement, prosecution, incarceration, or community supervision. But there are a whole other sources of savings through reduced crime, to include things like reduced victimization, pain and suffering. You know, there's a host of savings. So it's depending on which philosophy of monetizing crime you adhere to, you're going to get very different figures. So I can't put a number on that. That's a pretty charged conversation, and I'm not up to on the research on that.
If you flip two slides farther along, you have the Kansas profile, and then you have the Texas profile. That's the next one. Can you outline? There's quite a contrast between the two of those. Can you break out, you know, what percentage of Kansas is felony property person, Texas felony property person?
Of the current offenders behind bars?
Right.
I don't have that with me right now. I could find that out for you.
Because just a two quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. I mean, because the comment, I mean, the question to me is, how do we do more for less on property crimes? And as I made mention to you, I mean, we already have counties that are don't prosecute under $5,000 because they simply can't afford to, and so therefore, that kind of, like I say, we're on the opposite side of the bell curve. I'm a little curious of your comments of how we can do more with less in theory, but get below the 5,000 property crimes. So does it? And then lastly, if you could comment, what states have earned time versus grant time, and I guess explain it. I understand Oregon's model is earned time, but it's for judicial reasons, not the legislator, judicial reasons they've created this, oh, you must tell them in advance, so they get their earned time as granted time, and it works backwards, versus other states. Can you give examples that actually have, quote, earned time that maybe every 6 months they earn that time?
Sure. A few questions in there, so I'm just taking quick notes here. So first on what to do about property crime. The analysis I did of Oregon before coming in here was quite cursory. As compared with the intensive technical assistance we provide in other states where we really dive into the numbers and we gather a lot of data. So please take all the following things I say with that caveat, which is I've not done an intensive analysis of drivers of crime and correctional populations and spending in Oregon. That said, largely what it looks like is that if what you're saying about essentially diverting or not even prosecuting, certainly not sending too many of those folks to prison, yet you still have a relatively high property crime rate in the state, what it indicates to me is a substantial need for investment in community corrections. We know a lot more about how do you control the behavior of these offenders through supervision, sanctions, and services than we did 20 years ago. We have some pretty good models for how to keep folks towing the line, paying victim restitution, child support, taxes, and how to assist them to live lives absent from drugs and alcohol. So that to me seems like the logical place to look. Again, I haven't done an intensive analysis of what the current community supervision policies and practices of the state look like. By reputation, they're quite good, but it may just be an issue of resources, maybe an issue of restrictions on what policies they're allowed to use and not allowed to use, where the administrative sanctioning capacity is at the discretion of counties versus others. That requires a whole lot more analysis. If I could turn to the earn time question, and if it pleases the group here, we could do a little deeper dive into the earn time discussion because I realize it has been. Let me just find the slide here. Appropriate slide. It's been
on the radar and under current discussion.
So the first thing I just want to say is that there's a fair number of research studies out there on earn time. They are not of uniformly high quality. The criminal justice in general suffers from a problem that we can't do experiments. So the way in the medical field it progresses is you want to try a new drug, you do a randomized controlled trial. Half the people get a placebo and we see what does better. We don't do that for obvious reasons in sentencing and corrections. We're not going to randomly assign some folks to probation versus some folks to prison and see who does better. So this is a limitation to a lot of what we know about policies in sentencing corrections. So let me just cite three studies on earn time, and then I'll get to some of the specific questions you put out there. The first is a review of the literature put together by a group called NCCD in California. They looked across 13 studies of earn time or accelerated release policies, and they found essentially no impact on recidivism. Some of these studies were not super high quality, meaning they didn't have very rigorously controlled comparison groups. certainly no random assignment. So these are, you know, they're working with what they have, essentially from the field. But the conclusion of that study was no effect on recidivism. Now, saying no effect on recidivism is not saying no effect on crime, because if someone is released earlier than they would have been otherwise, they're on the street longer. And so you lose some of the incapacitation effect of prison. Right? So when people are behind bars, they cannot commit crimes against free citizens. So that's the additional thing we have to consider here, not just deterrence, but incapacitation.
So probably the best recent study on that comes from the Washington State Institute for Public Policy, which analyzed
an expansion of earned time policy in that state. They went from, 50% requirements for serving 50% of the sentence to 33, and then they compared it to four comparison groups. I'll try to summarize concisely what they found. For the folks who went through the earned time policy, felony recidivism decreased 3.5%. So if you received the earned time policy, you were less likely to reoffend. That, they projected, saved $5,100 per offender in reduced crime and $3,000 per offender in reduced criminal justice processing costs. They calculated that the average offender who received the earned time credits served 63 fewer days behind bars, saving the state $5,500. And they estimated that those offenders received $1,800 in employment, through earnings on outside, leading to total benefits of $15,400 per offender. But there's the cost side. So they projected what would be the increase in crime through fewer days behind bars. And they projected $8,200 in additional property crimes from lost incapacitation, which nets out to a savings of $7,000, a little over $7,000 per offender, which is a return on investment of approximately $1.90 for every $1 invested. So that's, that's the Washington State Institute. Pretty solid analysis overall. Some of the stuff is observed, others is projected findings. So there's always a good discussion around that, but that's what they found. And then the last case study I wanted to highlight here is one that we commissioned a memo from the JFA Institute on some recent earned time reforms in Mississippi. And I'll give you the results from that. So the quick background is that in 1995, Mississippi adopted 85% truth in sentencing statutes across the board, violent, property, drug. Everyone, 85%. The prison population doubled from that point until 2007. And then in 2008, a law reform changed allowing parole eligibility, that is not automatic release, right, become eligible for parole for nonviolent offenders at 25% of your sentence. This was retroactive, and so it made 3,000 inmates immediately eligible for parole. Under the previous guideline, these inmates eligible for parole under the 85% statute would have been eligible for release at 4.25 years, 4 1/4 years. With the new change, they're now eligible at 1 1/4 years. So a substantial change in the requirements for time served. They also, the new legislation also removed a 180-day cap on meritorious earn time, which gets back to your question on the differences, but we'll get to that in a minute. They also instituted a risk assessment tool for the parole board. So when inmates came up for their eligibility hearings, it wasn't just let's look at your behavior behind bars and your priors and your current crime of conviction. Let's also look at your actuarially assessed risk score. So the result of all this is that through August 2009, they had 3,076 inmates had been released under this law. There had been no uptick in the revocation rate. 121 of those 3,076 inmates who were released had been returned to custody, all but five of them on technical violations. The five, if you're curious, were four on burglaries and one DUI. And the population for Mississippi, which had projected to continue to increase substantially, stabilized. And they credit this policy with averting 5,000 beds worth of construction over a 10-year period. Now, last point I want to make on the Washington example and the Mississippi example is that both of those, they calculated the recidivism effect, they calculated the savings they would achieve from those policies. What they didn't do, but what the state could do, is take some of the savings that they achieved through those policies and reinvest those in other programs and policies that would increase public safety. So you could channel those savings to a police force. You could channel them to the state crime lab. You could channel them to probation parole. You could, you know, et cetera, right? And so while in both these cases, you're essentially looking at a wash in terms of public safety, right? No increase, apparently, through these studies in crime or victimization, but substantial savings. Now, if you took some portion of that savings and reinvested it, you could achieve sort of the dual outcomes of reduced crime and taxpayer savings. Sorry, and now get back to your question on the differences. The best study I can recommend on this is a piece put out by the National Conference of State Legislatures last year. I'll send you a link or a copy if you... Yeah. Okay. Essentially, you know, there's a nice table at the back that shows how states compare. Everything from good time to earned time. Is the earned time because of vocational, educational, rehab programs? How many days do you get? Is it a 1-for-1 credit, a 1-for-10 credit? Can it be revoked, rescinded, or given back to you? Huge variation across the states, and there's really no way I could do justice to the astounding variety of policies across the state, across the states. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a lot of detail in here, and it doesn't serve anyone's ends to sort of, you know, gloss over what are a lot of decisions that have to be made either by legislators or the folks in the agencies that have to implement these policies and execute them. So, you know, like you said, there's a huge difference between is it earned or is it given? If it's given, is it earned? You know, is it given to you the day you come in and you only lose it if you commit some infraction? Or do you have to earn it every month? Okay, we look at your chart, no infractions, you get 10 days for 30 saved. Right? So there are a lot of different ways to do this. There's no real evidence on what is the best way. And part of the reason for that is that states do look a lot different. So you have different types of offenders behind bars, you have different types of offenders in the community, you have a different sentencing guidelines grid than other states. So I can't come in and say what you guys should do is 17.4% for all nonviolent drug and property offenders, because I just, you know, you can't say that from outside. You really need to dig into the numbers, find out what's you know, really practical for the state.
All right. Before Senator Shields, I'm going to ask the people on the panel. Senator Westett.
Thank you. Actually, three questions. Regarding the recidivism cost, how is that computed? Is that computed on the basis of the crimes that the recidivite, to lack of a better word, was actually convicted of? Or was that figured on some formula of how many crimes that he was actually convicted of and probably also created but wasn't caught doing?
Yeah, my sense, I had to go back and look at the details, but knowing how Washington State has done some of these studies in the past, is that the reduced recidivism savings were projected by, they have a comparison group. So folks either before the legislative change or after the legislative change who didn't receive the credit, and they observe their recidivism rate after departure from prison. And then they look at the group that received the credit, okay? And you compare their observed recidivism rate. So that is, what were they convicted or returned to the state DOC for? And then what they probably do is look at what those crimes are and multiply those by some monetary cost, right? So in general, there are a few traditional research studies that criminologists turn to in finding out, in sort of estimating a cost of a crime. And again, going back to the discussion or the mention I made earlier, this is tough stuff, and there's a lot of assumptions that go into it. But at least it's consistent across offenders, and you can explain your methodology. So those would be observed cost savings. So that would not compensate for crimes committed but not observed by police or others. On the other side, the increase in crime through the lost incapacitation, so the fact that folks got out earlier, they're on the street more days than they otherwise would have been, that's a pure projection. So that was not an observed effect. That was not based on folks coming back to the system or being arrested. That was based on some assumptions around what researchers call the elasticity of crime to incarceration. So, they, you know, based on past research studies, you can say if the incarceration rate goes up this much, it goes down that much, crime will go up this or that much. But it's a assumption based on research that they applied then to crime statistics in Washington. But I'd be glad to, if you want to talk about the study a little more, we could talk offline, or I could provide a follow-up memo.
Thank you. The second question, it appears that Oregon is pretty much average in the number of people in, percentage of people in jail or in prison, and the of those under correction supervision, nationally it's about 30% that are in jail or prison. In Oregon it's actually 24%, which is about 20% less. In the total amount of people in prison, about 0.625% nationally, 2.5% under total correction. Oregon is in the, pretty much in the same ballpark. And yet Oregon has one of the highest cost per capita of corrections in the United States. Has Pew looked at that as far as why is Oregon so much more expensive in the cost of corrections per capita, measured not per capita in prison corrections, but both in prison corrections and in total per capita in the state? Why are we so expensive?
So I have not looked into Oregon's numbers in detail on those. So I can't answer that outright. I can give you a couple informed theories. One would be that spending in other areas is lower. The other could be that you throw more of your the across 50 state data on this is decent but not perfect. So different states put different line items from their budget into what they call their correction spending figure. If you folks, in comparison to other states, put more of your line items into what you call your corrections budget, then it would look inflated. There could be other issues. I mean, labor costs different amounts across the country. In general, labor's cheaper in the South. It's more expensive in the North. It's a lot more expensive in the Northeast, where I'm from. So that could explain a good chunk of it. There's a lot of things that, I think that might be one of the large ones, right, which is that labor is just more expensive. And I'm not saying that Oregon compared to your neighboring states. I'm just saying in general, there's some other states that where labor is a lot cheaper. So that those could all play into it.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, one other question, and this is more for you and Senator Shields, I believe, but I recall that there was a bill in the 2009 legislature that would have created a Oregon HOPE program. Can you discuss what that program was and why didn't it pass?
I think it passed out of Judiciary, went down to Ways and Means, and we didn't have the money to fund it.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I believe it passed out of the House Judiciary Committee, went down to Ways and Means, and we didn't have the money to fund it.
Okay.
I asked him to turn it down and he's turned it up.
I have a question.
It's a
Senator Baldacci.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. On the slide that's titled The Common Denominators, there's some information about Oregon having Oregon prisoners 15% severe mental health problems and 60% severe substance abuse problems. And I wonder if you know how those percentages compare with other states.
I think the problem, so I pulled these numbers again off Oregon state websites and different presentations made by state officials. And again, this gets down to a definitional issue. So what is defined as a severe mental health issue? What diagnostic tool was it using? What threshold did it employ? So it's very difficult to apply across state. In general, I think it's no surprise to most folks that we see a lot of substance abuse and mental health issues, a lot higher prevalence among correctional populations and inmate populations than among the general population. Mental health tends to be particularly elevated amongst female inmates. I think, it catches no one by surprise. That said, it's difficult to compare across states because few tools are applied across states in consistent ways. I'd be glad to follow up with you to try to dig into that a little bit. I think on some level, though, it comes down to a decision for Oregon policymakers, essentially, that if this is the presenting problem for some portion of your state's inmates or criminal offenders more broadly, what policies and programs can you look to address it? And there are a few organizations out there that do quite good work on this. One I'd point you to is the Consensus Project of the Council of State Governments Justice Center, particularly looking at how to deal with mental health and co-occurring disorders amongst the criminal justice population.
Thank you.
Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I have a question also related to that figure. And I know that Pew does a lot of work on drug and alcohol prevention and treatment around the country. Has there been I mean, we're talking about a population that's already in the correctional system. Mm-hmm. And as policymakers, one of the things that we need to think about is investing dollars up front in prevention and how that can save us in the long term in our correctional system, public safety system. Has Pew linked the two and come up with some recommendations about the most successful prevention tools that states have? Mm-hmm. I know that may not be your particular area of expertise, but when we're looking at the amount of people, and I understand there could be some overlap between this 15% of mental health and the 60% with the substance abuse, and there's probably a lot of quite a bit of combination there. But when we're talking about, and I know that Oregon is not unique in the amount of folks in our system with substance abuse, the amount of dollars invested up front that can save us in the long term in our correctional system, any information that you have or programs that Pew may be researching that we can target would be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fantastic question. I think my answer won't be totally satisfying. I think, you know, part of what it comes down to is that this is very difficult stuff to handle as policymakers and as practitioners in the field. You know, if it was an easier problem, states would be doing a better job and we wouldn't see these numbers. But that said, I think there are a few resources I'd point you to. The first, again, the Council of State Governments Justice Center, the Consensus Project. This is actually playing out increasingly in our state technical assistance efforts. So I'd say you know, this emphasis is still sentencing and corrections, but with a particular eye towards these populations. And they now have a few specialists on staff that are helping in these technical assistance efforts, because when you go into a state, you cannot just tackle a sentencing and corrections issue without looking at these other sectors, looking at health, specialized health, high-risk populations, et cetera. So, you know, that said, there's not really a guide across state. I mean, I would really encourage you to take a look at some of their work. The second is the Washington State Institute of Public Policy has put out some great publications on this. They have a 2006 study I'd be glad to point you towards, where they talk about the return on investment from these other types of investments, right? So, and what they did in that program is they looked across all evaluations conducted in English, right? So no matter where in the world they occurred, although most of them, because of the research funding, were conducted in the U.S., and they looked at what is the effect of this program on crime, what are the savings associated with that reduction in crime, what are the costs associated with the program, what are the net benefits per participant, and you can, and it reads almost like a menu. You can look down, you know, adult criminal justice populations, juvenile justice populations, early childhood interventions, everything from nurse-family partnerships to high-quality pre-K, you know, and look at, you know, it, for every dollar you invest here, how much do you receive in benefits? You know, that's a great study in the sense that it really gets folks to focus on the return on investment, comparison across programs, and answer the question not just, is this an effective program, but is this a cost-effective program, and is it more effective or more cost-effective than other programs? And then the third thing I'd point out here is that, and this I think, you know, particularly for states like yours facing pretty pressing, you know, budget pressure, and likely see that in you know, in 2011, 2012, et cetera, is as states face this, the sort of rash states are making cuts in programming. Right, because it's an easy thing to cut this year. We can shave $180,000 here, $2 million there, et cetera, and plug a few budget holes. Problem is, some of these cuts in programs are sort of the penny-wise, pound-foolish approach. What we're seeing in a bunch of states is that, for instance, if you have a state where parole eligibility is contingent on completing a risk reduction rehabilitation program, and then you cut that program, folks can no longer be parole eligible. You then have a backup in your parole eligibility lists. People stay behind bars longer. You're paying $30,000 per year, let's say, for these inmates. And so you may have cut that $200,000, $2 million, $8 million up front, but you're going to pay for it in longer time served on the back end. And so just being really careful about the unintended consequences of cuts to these programs.
Thank you.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jake, do you know if the incarceration rate statistics and the comparison of offender makeup in various state populations, violent versus property versus drug, are apples to apples comparisons? Because Oregon has about, I think, around 360 per 100,000. Washington has about 260 per 100,000. We're potentially under the incarceration rates of other states, but what we do is we keep parole and probation violators, as you know, generally locked up in community corrections part of the budget in jails. And I'm not sure, maybe this would be a better question for the Department of Corrections, but if you added, if we're not including the people in the jail population in that, it might be vastly different. Our incarceration rate might be 460, for all I know. And I would think also that the parole and probation violators intuitively would tend to be property and drug offenders versus some of the more violent offenders. But
And there's a lot packed up in that question. I think just starting with the recidivism rate issue, the rates we quoted before, those do include prison and jail. But I think the point you're getting at here is our recidivism rates are different across states. Are they apples to apples? And in particular, do the other states count recidivism to jails as opposed to prisons?
Actually, not recidivism rates, incarceration rates.
Incarceration
per 100,000.
So the rates, I'm pretty sure the rates, I have to look into this to raise the question, but I think, you know, the rates in Oregon are still below national averages. We don't have statistics on by offense type recidivism rates. So for instance, we don't know what share of your jail inmates are violent versus property versus drug. So I can't break it out that way. But you know, your point is absolutely right, which is that the states like Pennsylvania, where you can serve 2 to 5 years in a jail, whereas a lot of states, you know, 1 year is the cutoff. My home state of Massachusetts, we have a jail system, a county jail system, a state prison system. You've got Texas with state jails. I mean, there's a huge variation across the state. So I agree with you. You know, if we looked more like England, where there's one system of incarceration across the whole country, it'd be a whole lot easier to count. But we don't look like that, and we are not gonna look like that for in a short term. So I think it's the right question, and I'd always approach interstate comparisons with some skepticism and ask the tough questions. But I agree with you. Maybe the state DOC is the good source for the answer.
And then can I make one follow-up?
You may.
I don't know if you've seen the 2008 numbers on property crime, but our property crime numbers based on the FBI UCR continued to plummet, as well as our violent crime rates, and we're now within 2 percentage points of the national average.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating story, right? The crime decline since the early 90s has been an astounding thing, and criminologists are still struggling to explain it. And it's continuing, apparently, now amidst recession and increased unemployment. And in a lot of states, it's actually continuing amidst decreased incarceration rates. It'd be another thing I'd be glad if folks want to talk about the relationship between incarceration and crime, or a few of those states that are, like Kansas, like Texas, dropping their crime rates while dropping their incarceration rates.
All right. Senator Wissett?
Just want to follow up quickly. Yep. I mean, it brought up an interesting thought. We see this fall in crime rate, particularly from 95 to 2002, is probably the statistically significant part, and it just falls off precipitously, and then it kind of levels out again. Now it's my understanding it's starting to go down again. During the last decade or so, the number of private gun owners has increased in the United States very significantly. Is there any relationship between those two?
This is an area I've read a bit about, but I'm kind of the armchair sociologist in that area, and I'm not an expert in it. Can't comment too much on it. I've heard some criticism about the research in that if you change the parameters, for instance, if you analyze it at a state level versus a county level versus a local level, you get different results, which sort of in the econometric language, that means the results are sensitive to the parameters you use to estimate it, meaning that they're... There's questions about how robust some of those findings are, but this is the case in a lot of research, right? If you change some of the parameters, the findings change a bit. But again, not an area I'm an expert in.
That's particularly true of modeled parameters, yes.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Jake, let me ask you, we have about 15 minutes left before we would be shutting down. How much time do you have left? And the reason I ask is if you have a little bit more time, there's been people here in the public. I might ask them if anyone wants to come up and pose a question based on your presentation.
Sure.
All right. So is there anyone here in the public arena that would like to come forward and pose a question to our presenter? Come on up.
I did not sign up.
That's what you're going to do is you're going to sit down, you're going to tell us your name, and then you're going to pose the question, and we'll see if we can get any responses.
My name is Peyton Llewellyn. I'm a citizen of Polk County nearby. My question has to do with, it's peripheral to this. I wanted to know if in these, in the studies that were presented today, anything to do with registration of sex offenders and the comparative, whether it's successful or not, as far as public safety is concerned.
Yeah, I think if I got a question is, have you done any research or seen any studies that have been done as to states that have a sex offender registration as to, I assume, the recidivism rate of those individuals?
We've done no research on that. I'm not aware of the current state of the research on it. Sorry.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that came up that maybe you'd comment on, and I'm not quite sure because we mentioned crime reporting, an interesting phenomenon in some of the counties that, I have. And that is, again, because of budgets, you have 2 and 3 property crimes happening to a single property over a 2 or 3 month period. Mm-hmm. And rather than being new case numbers, they're all just lumped into the same one. Because someone said, you know, maybe in the old days you'd have 3 property crimes there, and now they're just one, because they just add the material to the case information rather than add a new case to it. And how does that work in the reporting system going to the FBI? And you may not know the answer to that, but I'm just kind of, because we always use the FBI study, I think.
Sure. Yeah, I'm not an expert in FBI, UCR crime statistics. And it sounds like, you know, it could be an issue for the numbers, particularly if that, if the practice of law enforcement in recording those crime statistics has changed over time. You know, if it's been consistent over time, then you essentially have a scaling problem that it, you know, takes care of itself. But if their practices have changed because of increased crime or just a change in practice, then that might skew the statistics or create some bias in them. But I'm not aware of it.
Thank you, Mr.
Steve.
Thank you, Chairman. Steve Dole, Crime Victims United. Jake, in you have a 2008 report, and in that paper, the Pew report said that increasing incarceration has, quote, failed to have a clear impact on recidivism or overall crime. Yet Oregon's violent crime rate has dropped by 49%, our recidivism rates are down, and the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission says that we prevent 100,000 crimes every year because of increased incarceration. How do you square that with, quote, failing to have a clear impact on recidivism or overall crime?
Mm-hmm. So if I could just dive in, because I think this is a part of a larger discussion, and have a few, you know, this is a complex area, and there's good research reason it's a complex area. We can dive into those later, but let's just do a quick overview of sort of the relationship between incarceration and crime. So the statistic most commonly cited is the Spellman-Levitt studies that indicated about 25% of the crime reduction of the 90s was due to increased incarceration. You know, other researchers like Bruce Western at Harvard indicate it's closer to 10%. A recent study by Peel and Liedka indicate that while the 25% figure might apply in the 90s or the 80s when we had 300 per 100,000 behind bars or 400 per 100,000, it's a lot less impactful nowadays when we have over 500 per 100,000. So this is the idea of diminishing marginal returns. That as you add more and more people to the incarcerated rolls, you get smaller and smaller fish, essentially, and you're incapacitating fewer crimes through the increased incarceration rates. So a few things about this. The first is that Let's say we ignore the challenges to the Spellman and Levitt research and say, okay, at 25% reduction of crime due to incarceration, there's a few things that raises. First is, what caused the other 75%, the majority of the crime decline, that wasn't incarceration? And then there's a few reasons to, you know, a lot of people think, you know, incarceration, obviously, that would reduce crime. But there are a bunch of reasons that incarceration can fail to reduce crime or can reduce less crime than we would expect it to. The first is this idea of diminishing marginal returns. So as you increase the prison population, you get less risky folks or folks who commit fewer crimes. Analysis both in Oregon and Washington back this up, that this is what's been occurring, that the number of crimes averted through each additional prisoner you put behind bars averts fewer and fewer crimes than it did when you had fewer prisoners. The second is the issue of replacement. So to the extent that crime is taking part as place in a robust market, the most obvious examples being drug dealing, and theft for fencing, You know, you incarcerate one of those offenders, and another person's there on the street the next day to take their place, right? Drug markets don't go away because you arrest someone. These are robust markets. They're supply and demand, and people will fill empty positions. So if you incarcerate one of those folks, the crime still occurs the next day. The third is the issue of aging out. So one of the most robust findings across all the criminological research is that arrest rates follow a very predictable age curve, right? So criminal careers onset in the teens and late teens, persist through the early 20s, and then very quickly taper off. Okay, this is across multiple types of crime. This is across any state that cares to look at these numbers. And so to the extent that you incarcerate people beyond the years that, during which they would have been committing crimes, you don't incapacitate crime. This gets at a length of stay issue. And the last reason here is sort of the rules of deterrence, which I alluded to before when talking about the HOPE program and other programs like that. If you want to deter crime, you need to focus on certainty and swiftness. Severity is very unimportant when it comes to deterrence. Yet incarceration and the policy surrounding it almost only influence severity, right? Because the term incarceration is usually after months of pretrial detention, hearings, plea negotiations, perhaps a trial in those rare cases, and the certainty is quite low. Offenders don't have that kind of downstream vision. They're bad at delaying gratification, and that's why they commit crimes in the first place, right? So there's a lot of reasons to doubt the effectiveness, or at least indicate there's a decreasing effectiveness of incarceration. And finally, the issue of effectiveness is very different than the issue of what's the most cost-effective way. So we can say, and I think a lot of folks in this field agree, that incarceration has reduced crime. It's unclear how much, how robust, how, is it 20%, is it 10%, is it 35%? Researchers will continue to disagree about that. But not too many people disagree that it's the most expensive way to reduce crime. And so the question is, can you find a more cost-effective way to reduce crime than incarceration? This chart, I hesitate to throw it up because it's a little dizzying, but essentially what this chart shows is crime is on the x-axis. So the lower you are on that chart, the more you reduced crime. You can see Oregon's in the lower right there. So crime rates dropped 40%. The y-axis across the top is the change in incarceration rate. This is from 97 to 07. So the further you are to the right, the more you increased your prison population. So if you look at Oregon in respect to other states on this chart, you see that Oregon had one of the largest crime decreases of the past decade. And that is good stuff for the state. It also had one of the largest increases in incarceration rates of any state. And so what you got to consider is where else could you be on that chart? So if you scan to the left of Oregon, you come across Utah. Utah had almost the exact same decrease in crime as Oregon, but it only increased its incarceration rate by 20% instead of 60%. You keep scanning left, you come to New York. New York State reduced its crime rate by almost the exact same figure as Oregon, and it decreased its prison population and its incarceration rate over that 10-year period. So getting back to the question here, I think the evidence is in that incarceration reduces crime. It's unclear by how much it reduces crime. It's further not concluded that it's the most cost-effective way to reduce crime, and it certainly isn't the case that you can, states are proving you can reduce your incarceration rate and your crime rate. The last slide on this here is comparing a few states that did that. So on the left, you got the United States. It increased its incarceration rate by 14%, dropped its crime rate by 24% over a 10-year period. You got states like Maryland, New Jersey, New York, that decreased their crime rates and decreased their incarceration rates. And those aren't the other states. Nevada falls in this category. A couple other states do as well. And you see states like New Jersey and New York dropping their crime rate by the same figures Oregon did, while meantime dropping their incarceration rates. I don't know if I have. And just if I could, one last point on, is it okay? I don't want to go over the time here.
No, what I was going to do is, before you ask the next question, I want to find out if there's anyone else here that wanted to ask a question, because we have 5 minutes left, and I want to give kind of equal time.
I just had a comment and a quick follow-up to that question. Comment is this. I know that New York's incarceration rate went down. They had one of the most draconian drug laws in the United States, and they cut those drug laws. So that leads to my follow-up question. Your 2008 report says that we are imprisoning the wrong people in Oregon. In Oregon, no one goes to prison for using or possessing drugs. 69% of our prison inmates are violent, and 77% of our felons receive probation sentences. So how do you figure we're imprisoning the wrong people?
We had to discuss maybe offline. The reports I've worked on for Pew, including the 100-131 reports, which sounds like one of the two you're referencing there, didn't say any state was incarcerating the wrong felons because it wasn't a individual state analysis, which takes real intensive work in the state on the ground. What we were saying in the 1-in-100 report is that states like Texas, Kansas, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, now New Hampshire, hopefully in the next couple of years, states like Ohio and Florida are finding ways to improve public safety, hold offenders more accountable, and contain their correction spending. This is the, we're seeing states do this. This isn't sort of the Pew opinion. This is what states like Texas and Kansas have done. They're doing it by analyzing who's behind bars, why they go there. They're doing it by auditing their policies and figuring out if we tweak some of our policies and did a better job of screening and sorting offenders, better job of holding them accountable, increasing the deterrent message that are applied to them, addressing their criminogenic needs like substance abuse and mental health. We can get better results, not just for citizens in terms of victimization and crime, but for taxpayers in terms of the cost of the correctional system.
Thank you. Brian?
Thank you.
Yep.
For the record, I represent a number of public safety organizations in the state, including some corrections folks. Did I hear you correctly that the percentage of people with acute mental health in Oregon was higher than the national average or on the higher end of that?
No, I didn't make a comparison between Oregon and other states. The figures, like we said, sometimes apples to oranges, and I'm not aware of the how Oregon defines and categorizes.
Obviously, that was a key issue for me, and I'm obviously heard incorrectly, but what I hear from our correctional officers is that they see a lot more people with acute mental health needs in the correctional facility. Are you aware of any studies that that compare the in-house assaults or predatory behavior, because you have an increased number of people with mental health needs, they're actually in the criminal system rather than the mental health system?
Yeah, I'm not personally expert in that area, not aware of those studies, but I could certainly try to dig them up.
Okay, obviously the line of questioning that I had is... Thank you.
Thank you. Jack, I want to thank you very much for coming and giving us some of your valuable time to do the presentation. I understand you're going to be sending to us the PowerPoints. And I'm wondering, some of the slides that you have referenced toward the end were not part of that presentation.
I'll include those.
If it's all right, we'd love to have those as well. And thank you. Any other questions, any comments? All right, I want to thank everyone for being here this morning. We're going to be in session tomorrow here in committee, but we're not going to start until 8:30 tomorrow, Tuesday. With that, we're adjourned.